This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, a very special Memorial Day edition of the program. On this program, each week we realize that no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. Men and sometimes women who have stories of incredible sacrifice and service for the sake of our country. And we want to honor our veterans for that. We want to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And we certainly learn a lot along the journey. Usually, we listen to veterans, primarily from World War II, telling us their stories of what they did all those years ago. But each year when Memorial Day rolls around, I think it's important for us to take pause and focus on those who didn't get to come home and tell their stories. So many from World War II, more than 400,000, close to 35,000 from the Korean War who died while serving our country, and another 58,000 during Vietnam, not to mention those who have passed in recent years, all while wearing the uniform of the United States. And every year around Memorial Day, we get to learn about folks who maybe we wouldn't know about otherwise. And in this case, it was a great mystery. I want to welcome in Jim Escal, the author of the book Unforgotten Hero. And we're going to find out who that unforgotten hero was. For many years, he was forgotten, or at least unknown, in your family, even though he has the same name you do. Tell me how you first started this journey that ultimately ended up with this phenomenal book here, Unforgotten Hero.
It all started one day. I was about 8 years old. I was kind of rummaging through my parents in their bedroom, looking through the closet, looking through the drawers. I wasn't supposed to be there. I was my guess is I was probably in there looking for Christmas presents my mother hid, as I usually did every year. And I came across this black and white photo showing a man in a flight helmet and goggles, which kind of, you know, piqued my interest because I was in aviation back in those days. And I was kind of curious about who this guy was because I'd never seen him before. So I asked my mother, I said, who is this guy? And she said, oh, well, that's your Uncle Jimmy, your dad's brother. He was an Air Force pilot like your dad, but he never came home from the Korean War. So I was kind of curious. And then when she told me that I was named in honor of him, well, that kind of sparked my interest. I want to find out more about him. I wanted to find out about his role in the Air Force, the Korean War, and I didn't want him to be forgotten like the war itself has become over the years for many people.
The Korean War, famously known as the Forgotten War. But in this case, your Uncle Jimmy wasn't forgotten. He was unknown to you. You'd never even known he existed, right?
No, I didn't know I had an uncle until I saw the picture, and then she told me who he was. He was unknown to me. I had no idea who he was.
Had you known what your father did in the service?
Oh, yeah. I knew about his role in the Air Force. He was a fighter pilot. You know, he's got lots of pictures I saw because, again, with the going to the dresser drawers, you know, he has the pilot wings and all that stuff. So I kind of looked through that. I knew about his role, but I had no idea. He never told me anything about my uncle.
So Uncle Jimmy, this is a whole revelation to you, and I think it's important for people to hear your story because so many folks, maybe they've lost a relative and they know nothing about what that relative did in the service, whether it's World War II or Korea or Vietnam. And the bottom line is if you set out to discover some information, you never know where that trail is going to lead. And I think your story certainly underscores that. So you get this curiosity piqued as an 8-year-old. When did you start to do something about it and start to discover more and more information about what your uncle did?
Well, I spent a lot of time in the summer with my grandfather. And of course, he had all the, you know, he had a scrapbook of old newspaper articles based on my uncle's pilot training days. He kept all the newspaper clippings and stuff. So I'd spent some summers with him quite a few times. I'd go up, help him with the farming and stuff like that. I'd come back to his house. And while he's kind of, you know, relaxing in the chair there, I just kind of peek at these photographs that happened to be on an old, like a phonograph set in his living room. And I was kind of curious, so I asked him, I said, do you have any, like, did he get any medals? Are there any, like, photos I could look at? So he kind of helped me with that. So I kind of had a few things to look at from that point. And as time went on, like, I looked at some more pictures in the scrapbook, and then my mother happened to show me some old letters from him, so I kind of know what squadron he was in. I finally found out what group he was in. And one thing led to another year by year, but it took a while. It took a while to get there, piece by piece.
But what was driving it for you? Why was it so important for you to discover this information?
I guess it was just curiosity for me. It wasn't like I lost my father. It was my uncle, but it was still somebody I wanted to know, especially somebody I was named after. I wanted to know who he was. It's not so much how he died, it's about how he lived. What was his life about? you know, what kind of personality did he have when he was in the Air Force? What kind of pilot was he? Was he good? Was he bad? And then I just looked at these pilots' class books, and I saw all these faces of these young guys that happened to know him at the time. And I said, man, if I could only talk to them, find out how what my uncle was like, what kind of pilot was he? So that just kind of drove me. It's that curiosity factor.
Sure. So take us on that journey. And, you know, your book certainly fleshes this out. And the book has quite a bit of information about his upbringing in rural California in the San Joaquin Valley and some of the things that he went through. But you start out knowing next to nothing about him. Well, you didn't even know he existed.
Mm-mm.
What about your family, though? Did your family know anything about his decorations, his death, some of the details of his service in the Korean War?
I'm pretty sure my dad knew. But he was so busy raising a family of five. He was self-employed. So he really never, paid a lot of attention to it on a daily basis. My grandfather knew, but he was kind of he didn't say too much. So I don't know if he's kind of holding a lot of back, because he had a problem when my uncle disappeared and became MIA. He just kind of just withdrew himself. So he still has a little, memory every time you mention something.
Sure.
So, but I just went from that point on. I just, just a little bit here, a little bit there. But this was the days before the internet, of course.
Yeah.
So I just took whatever material I could find as they found it. I really wasn't aggressively seeking it, because when you're a young teenager, especially, you got your own things, school and whatever.
Sure.
And so you get things that, pop in here once in a while.
So when you had opportunity, a piece becomes clearer here and another piece there. And I think it's important what you said about your grandfather, because that's part of this story. When we think about Memorial Day and we think about all the Americans who've given their lives for our country, it's not just that person and that person's sacrifice. Their families sacrifice. Their families are changed forever. And it's so hard for parents who lose a child in war. And you saw that in your grandfather's experience. And I'm sure you're getting a taste of this as you go along this journey. And ultimately, you found out a lot of stuff that your family really didn't know, right?
Oh, yeah. Actually, they didn't have his records, his Air Force records. I guess they just didn't want to get them, I guess. I have no idea. I finally got his Air Force records. I put those pieces together. I bought my first computer. I could do a lot of research. And I just happened to see a website that there was a squadron picture with the names of these pilots. And it just happened to be put on there by one of his squadron mates, which I didn't know at the time. And that's why I could do all my research. I sent letters to everybody. I just mailed out the old-fashioned way. Just put stamps on. I was lucky in many cases.
You found folks who had served with your uncle.
Yes. And I was actually, I talked to them, or they corresponded me versus, with letters or emails. It was kind of eye-opening scenario there.
Well, help us understand the story. I mean, we can't read page by page through your book, and we wouldn't want to spoil all of it anyway, because some folks are going to want to find it, Unforgotten Hero. You can look it up on Amazon.com. Jim Escal is the author. So in learning about your Uncle Jimmy, what would be that picture if you had to tell us in a nutshell who he was, the kind of person he was, the things that stand out about the picture you've developed of him? Who was he? What kind of guy was he? What was he all about?
I found out he was a very people-oriented person. One lady who knew him in elementary school said he never knew a stranger. He was always helpful. He'd loan out, like when he had his car, he'd loan out to whoever needed it for a drive or someone to pick up some groceries. He helped elderly people if necessary. So he was a very outgoing person he was a studious person, unlike my dad, who didn't care for schoolwork too much. But my uncle was very straightforward. I mean, he had a seriousness. He had a goal that he wanted to do something to get out of the farm life. He wanted to fly since he was 5 years old. So he had a determination, a drive.
And he achieved that goal. He became a jet fighter pilot in the U.S. Air Force, flying the F-86, one of the early jet fighters. And as you started to learn more and more, what did you come to understand about what he was doing over there in the Korean War? What kinds of missions was he flying, and how dangerous were they?
From the letters, I found out he was from a fighter-bomber squadron, which meant not only, they had a possibility to go air-to-air to fight the MiGs, but his role was air-to-ground, which was the hardest and the most dangerous missions. So, they could go dive bombing, they could go skip bombing, they could go strafing, everything low to the ground. They have machine guns firing against them, etc. And they lost quite a few good pilots, too. So it was pretty dangerous.
So you start out knowing that obviously he never came home, but also knowing his body has never been recovered. And I don't know if a lot of people out there realize that because North Korea is still a communist regime that is closed off really to the rest of the world, that there are so many Americans whose bodies have never been recovered, and your uncle's is one of them. So there's a mystery in this whole thing. Did you set out thinking ultimately you were going to solve that mystery and find a way to bring him his remains home?
The thought crossed my mind, to be honest with you, but I really wasn't focused on that. I just wanted to know who he was, mm-hmm. and what happened to him, and trace from the beginning to the end. Now, if that came along, that'd be really nice. And I was hoping so maybe somebody would tell me. I put letters to the government offices, et cetera, and other people who were expert in the field would help me out. But there's no – it was like a dead end, basically.
Mm-hmm. You know, so far.
Yeah, so far. So hopefully, maybe down the road, something will open up. But North Korea, like you said, it's a closed country. And I know there's people here in our country would want to go over there and to search. And I'm sure they would find, you know, the remains of these pilots or other soldiers for that matter. But the doors close. So it just mattered when the doors could open and going in. So,
well, I'm sure there are a lot of people out there that are hoping with you and praying that those doors do open. But you have developed so much satisfaction and you've done so much for your family. And in sharing this story with others, touched a lot of lives. How has his story touched you? When you think about what he did, what are the things that you discovered were meaningful to you and might be meaningful to those folks listening right now to paint a picture of who this guy was and what he did for our country?
One thing I've done was find out how sacrificial he was, as was the other pilots in the squadron. I mean, they didn't think about themselves. They were a team. They worked as a team because he used to play baseball for many years, and it was always that team effort. If he made like a special play or something, he took the focus off himself. So he was very unselfish in that respect, and he always saw it as a group. So the focus was to do it for their country per se, not for themselves, not for glory. Like some of those guys that did the interceptor work, the MiGs, it was like a one-on-one. But these guys were a team. And they acted like a team. They worked as a team. And it's always to fight, to win. And that's what they went out for, you know. Mm-hmm.
And you started this journey not even knowing he existed. Again, not knowing anything that happened to him. You find out that he actually was highly decorated. Maybe a lot of folks haven't heard of the Soldier's Medal. We've had some guys on this program that have earned that. But it's just about as high as a Distinguished Flying Cross, a Silver Star. It just is something awarded for a non-combat situation. So what did he do to earn that Soldier's Medal?
He and his flight leader were coming back from a mission, and they're taxiing their aircraft to find the revetments to park the aircraft when he spotted an APU, which is an auxiliary power unit, was hooked to an F-86. And I guess another F-86, I guess, discharged a 50 caliber round accidentally and pierced the gas tank of the APU, which set it ablaze. And so my uncle, what he did, he just stopped his plane, got out, unstrapped himself, and just rushed right into the fire. And what some guys were trying to, airmen were trying to get the thing. So he took them out of the way, and he unhooked it and pushed the unit out of the way to clear it. Otherwise, it would damage the plane, and who knows what would happen.
So he put his own life in jeopardy, or at least, you know, risked injury to save equipment and potentially other airmen?
No, well, that's what his squadron commander stated. He just said he didn't think of his own personal affairs, nothing. He just rushed right in through the flames, just unplugged it and do what has to be done, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That was the way it was.
As you're learning these little tidbits about his life, and again, we're talking to Jim Escal, author of the book Unforgotten Hero, about his uncle, who he never knew existed till he found a photograph of a Korean War pilot who never made it home from the Korean War. As far as what did happen to him, in some ways, you still really don't know. I mean, you don't know for sure. You don't have hard and fast records of what happened to him when his plane went down, but you do know his plane did go down. What can you tell us about the circumstances of his final mission?
It's called Mission Bromide 21. It was an armed reconnaissance mission. It was on June 19, 1953, and the flight leader of that mission was the wing commander, four airplanes, and he was number three, and their job was to go bomb a personnel shelter that morning. And then after they drop their bombs, go to the secondary target, separate into elements, and scout around for any kind of trucks, convoys that were bringing the stuff up on the roads. Because it was during that time when the Chinese, North Koreans were bringing all this stuff up because they knew the truce was going to be signed soon. So they're looking for any opportunities, targets for opportunity, and that's basically where he got hit.
And how close to the armistice or the ceasefire?
About 5 weeks.
5 weeks.
Yeah.
If he had made it another 5 weeks, he probably would have come home. So on this mission, you know that his plane was shot down.
They're not sure because no one saw it being shot down, but they're assuming it was by automatic weapons fire since he was so low.
But they did find pieces of the plane.
Yeah, they found pieces of the plane. They found the tail section, part of a wing. So they knew it crashed.
So you know where the plane was found.
Yes.
But your uncle was never found.
Nope. No, they never found the body. No evidence of a parachute when his wingman was circling. They did find the airplane, but there was no evidence of a body anyplace nearby the plane or any place. And it was too dangerous. They couldn't send a helicopter rescue crew because North Korea and the weather started to sock in too because it was during that time of the typhoon season. So there was a double problem there.
So where does that take you? I'm sure people are listening. Okay, we know his plane went down. They found the tail intact. They found some other pieces, but there's no body. There's no evidence of the pilot whatsoever. What kind of possibilities run through your mind when you consider that evidence or lack thereof?
That's where the mystery part comes in. Where is he? Did he go down with the plane? Did he bail out? No one saw him. Did he get captured? Was he sent to the Soviet Union like some reports have stated? We don't know. That's the mystery part. You know, that's the hard part about MIA. You don't know what the status is. And even over the months after the war ended, or at least the armistice was signed, my grandfather would get these little reports. Well, he wasn't on a list of POWs that were repatriated. We have no evidence, et cetera. So, you know, it's like an open case, basically, for me.
And you mentioned this idea, and there's been a lot of signs pointing to there were American servicemen, and especially pilots, who ended up in this situation. Not necessarily your uncle. You don't know if he was one, but we do know that there likely were American pilots who were taken from North Korea back to the Soviet Union for intelligence purposes.
Yep.
So in your mind, your uncle could still be in the Soviet Union. I mean, that's a possibility, right?
It's possible. It's possible.
How old would he be?
Today, he'd be in his late 80s.
Mm-hmm.
If he was still alive.
So he could have died that day.
Yes.
He could have lived for a week, a month, a year, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years.
That's the hard part. You don't know. He could have survived and been captured. He could have died in a POW camp that wasn't on a registry. He could have been taken someplace out of the country. I've heard reports even they took POWs into China even. So, it's a big mystery.
But could there be clues to that mystery in a letter written one day before fighter pilot Jimmy Escal disappeared behind enemy lines in Korea? We're going to explore that when we come back. You can find Jim's book, Unforgotten Hero, on Amazon.com. I also have it linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. Right back with more of this Memorial Day special after this.
You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, marking Memorial Day weekend by learning about one of the nearly 8,000 Americans still unaccounted for from the Korean War, one of more than 5,000 still missing on the North Korean side of the demilitarized zone established on July 27, 1953, with the signing of the armistice. Jet fighter pilot Jimmy Escal was shot down a little more than a month before that, on June 19th. Our guest is that pilot's nephew, born 6 years after he went missing and named in his honor. Jim Escal has shared with us how he first learned that he even had an uncle when he was eight, how finding a photo in his parents' dresser sparked a quest that you can read about in the book Unforgotten Hero, Remembering a Fighter Pilot's Life, War, and Ultimate Sacrifice. I have a link to it at hometownheroesradio.com. And some of the things you'll find in the book are letters written before and after the decorated pilot's disappearance, letters that may yield some clues to his ultimate fate. Jim, can you share a couple of those with us?
Well, the first thing I have is the letter his flight leader sent to my grandparents a few days after my uncle disappeared. Dear Mr. and Mrs. Escal, we of Mike Flight feel that you are wondering about the details of the flight on which your son Jimmy became missing in action. With hopes that this might be your wish, I shall endeavor to give you the information in a brief form. On June 19, Jim was flying an armored reconnaissance patrol on a main supply route some 30 miles deep in enemy territory. The purpose of this mission was to seek enemy vehicles along the route and destroy them. During the patrol, Jim spotted a group of trucks and with his wingman began strafing passes on them. Since he and his wingman were making their passes in opposite directions to avoid as much anti-aircraft fire as possible, they lost visual contact with each other and maintained their relative positions to the trucks by radio calls. Jim called that he was going in on a second pass, so the wingman remained high, waiting for the call that Jim was off his target. When this call did not come for several seconds, the wingman began his second pass, having decided that Jim was already off. Upon pulling off the target, the wingman called Jim for his position, but received no answer. He then began circling the immediate area looking for Jim and calling him repeatedly from the radio. After considerable time in circling, calling, receiving no answer or sight of Jim, the wingman had to return home due to low fuel. When the wingman arrived at the base with his report, a flight was immediately sent back to the area to search. This flight searched over the entire area of the target and soon spotted the smoking wreckage of an aircraft a few miles south of the target. Since no sight was made of Jim and no radio calls were received from him, it is quite possible that he may have had to bail out in a hurry with no time for calls. However, in all honesty to you, chances are against this possibility. As flight commander of Mike Flight, I quickly found that Jim was one of our better pilots soon after his arrival here. I might add that as an officer and a buddy, he was one of the squadron's most popular men. His absence is well felt among us all. We all join with you in hopes and prayers that he will rejoin us again.
The first time you read that, you must have had goosebumps.
Oh, yeah. That got to me.
And if I'm hearing that correctly, he was basically saying it's possible that he bailed out, but more likely that he went into the ground and died.
Yeah, more likely he did than bail out.
Unfortunately, that letter right there contains more information than anything else ever really gave you about those circumstances, right?
It's basically a summary of what happened.
And because no one can get in there and do more investigation, you really don't have much other than that, other than they identified the plane with the tail number.
That's it. It's a locked door, basically. You can't get in the room.
You also have a letter from your Uncle Jim. And again, here you start this quest trying to learn about a guy who you never even knew existed until you find this photo. I imagine reading the words that he actually wrote had to be pretty meaningful.
Well, yes, it did. He wrote a letter the day before he became MIA. He wrote it to my father, who was at Nellis Air Force Base, going through his gunnery training. And he says, 18 June, 53, 0830. Hello there. Well, I'm AO today, so I finally found time to get off a couple letters. Hope you're flying by now. I bet you and G know Vegas pretty well by now. Hope you don't have to come over here, Bob. It would be better if you could stay in the States. If you went to Europe, it would be nice. I imagine you have been reading the papers about the big push the Chinese have made on our lines. I don't know how big they said it was, but it is big. The day it started, they had us in the air before the sun was up, and we didn't land until 9 o'clock that night. I got 4 missions that day, and I was so tired I could just walk, but it was fun. We kept this up for 2 days, and then the weather came in. I got 11 missions in 3 days. The day before the push started, I got 3 missions, and for the next 2 days, I got 4 missions each day. On the day I got 3, I had an interesting day. Our first mission that morning was a dive bombing mission on troops and supplies. We really plastered that target. The second mission was a Yalu River sweep. On this sweep, we climbed to 40,000 feet and dropped our tanks. Then we climbed up to 48,000 feet and started patrolling the Yalu River. We had just started west on our patrol when 10 MiGs came right across our nose. They were going in just the opposite direction as we were. By this time, we turned. They were way out in front of us. We finally had to break it off, they were patrolling a certain area. If we could have seen them a little sooner, we might have gotten a head-on shot or got on their tail sooner. Anyway, I have seen MiGs. Ha. I hope we can go on some more of those missions. When I dropped my tanks, it rolled out the wing and tore the pitot tube off. And then my radio went out, so I really had an interesting Yalu sweep. I had to make a formation landing due to the airspeed being out. Then the third mission that day was a skip bombing mission on a dam about 50 miles from Antung. We came in about 15 to 20 feet off the deck and bombed the dam. So that was an interesting mission. Next day, the big push started, and we were hitting the front line just as the sun came up. The T-6 directs us on these type of missions. The sky was full of 86s, 84s, Navy, Marine planes. We bombed the Chinese all day and after dark. After dark, we went down road behind the lines and shot up trucks. The flak was really heavy for those 2 days. We lost 3 F-86s from our group during these 2 days due to the ground fire. The sky was almost full of flak. After dark, you could see the tracers. It looked like a 4th of July in the late evening. There were lots of trucks moving up the front after dark. Boy, as soon as you would start down for the trucks, they would open up from both sides of the valley. We really worked for those 3 days, and I think we helped the soldiers a lot. Right after dark, you could see how hard their fighting was by all the flashes. Everyone still thinks the truce will be signed, the Chinese are just trying to get some good heels right now. Well, enough on the war. I'll write you some if I get some interesting missions. I have 40 missions now. Hurrah. We finally got a good night's sleep and a bath after 3 days due to the weather last night. I don't know how long it'll take for that present to get there. Well, I better get back to work. Tell everyone hello. Hey, on the first day of that big push, my squadron set a group, wing, and 5th Air Force record for sorties. We got 121 that day. Those crew chiefs and armament men really worked hard for us to set that record. Have fun. So long. Jim.
It's quite a treasure.
You learn quite a bit from these letters.
That probably tells you more than anything else you ever found.
You get a visual look. You just imagine what this scenario looks like by reading that.
Well, and because he's never been found, because he can't talk to you now, this was written a day before he disappeared.
Yep.
And don't you feel like in that letter, even though he didn't know what was going to happen the next day, he's given you a lot of clues to what did happen?
Yep.
When he talks about the anti-aircraft fire and how thick it was and how hard these guys are working to fly so many missions in so short a time?
It kind of puts a scenario in front of you visually. You could imagine in your mind what the scenario looks like.
The other thing that hit me, one of the first things he said in that letter, what did he say to your father?
I hope you don't have to come over here. I hope you can stay in the States. He knew the situation over there, how dangerous it was.
What year were you born?
I was born in 1959, 6 years after he disappeared.
So when you read that line, I hope you don't have to come over here, Bob.
And he wanted to. My dad wanted to go to Korea. But he emphasized, stay there if you can.
Because if your dad had gone over there and suffered the same fate.
It's happened to others, I've heard.
You wouldn't be here.
No, I wouldn't. Yeah, that's true. They eventually, my dad even petitioned the Air Force to be sent to Korea after the armistice. He still wanted to go there. But they said, okay, we don't need pilots there anymore. We're going to send you where we send you.
I want to ask you a question, and I don't know if it's fair to ask. It's probably a real tough one. But again, reading that letter, hearing you read that letter, written a day before he disappeared, and we talked about the different clues, and he has that haunting line to your dad, I hope you don't have to come over here.
He repeats that in about 3 of his letters.
So he keeps telling him that. I hope you don't have to come over here. He's telling him how crazy and intense these missions have been, flying 15 to 20 feet off the ground in anti-aircraft fire so thick that other planes are going down every time. Do you think he knew that something was going to happen to him?
Oh, they knew the possibilities every day. They can go on a mission and never come back. Because they were fighter-bomber pilots. They were just low to the ground. So they knew the possible circumstances each time they went on a mission. So that's why he was trying to, I think he was trying to warn my dad.
That's incredible. And before we got into the letters, you spoke to the mystery that remains. Since North Korea is closed off and no conclusive evidence has been found, there are several possible realities.
Clearly, you've considered all these possibilities, and I'm sure there's part of you that dreams that he did survive. But then when you think about that, how hard is it to imagine that he could be alive for some time after this happened and have no way of connecting at all with any kind of family or anyone back home?
Yeah, my grandmother thought about that especially, because she died, unfortunately, she died as well. My grandfather died without knowing what happened to their son, as in many cases, that's what happens. And it's just kind of heartfelt, you know, if he's in captivity, what is his daily life like? You know, is he eating? Is he being tortured? What the deal was? We have no clue. So it's difficult.
So at this point, this is still a mystery. And for so many other American families, they have that same mystery, a loved one who was never brought back. There are these kind of cases in World War II and in Vietnam, but Korea kind of takes it to another level because that territory has never been opened back up because of the way that war ended, and North Korea has remained the way it is. So when you look ahead and you allow yourself to hope, because obviously you had to have some belief throughout this thing to accomplish what you've done and to fill in so many blanks about your uncle's story, I'm sure that's added a lot to your life to know all of this, right?
Yes, it has. Quite a bit.
But I'm sure there's still something out there that you dream about and you think this would be the closure or the full circle, the ending, a new epilogue to this book that would really add something. So when you allow yourself to think about those things, what is it that you would like to see happen?
I like to be able to see North Korea open their doors and allow countries like ours to go in there and to search, like they do in Vietnam. We should be able to allow to go into North Korea and be able to search, you know, for our lost ones that are buried somewhere. And hopefully that'd be the case in the future.
And what would it take, do you think? Maybe that's a hard question to answer. Would a body, a piece of his uniform, a record of him being a prisoner somewhere? What would do it for you? What would kind of settle things in your mind?
Evidence might. I heard of a case where a businessman, another missing F-86 case, a businessman went into China and found some, like, you know, dog tags or identification of some sort. That in turn led to a search team coming in, and they found eventually, you know, the remains of him and brought him back. So if some kind of evidence would kind of make a clincher for me, that'd be helpful.
Why did you want to write the book? You talked about your fascination with your uncle from the time you saw that photo when you were 8 years old. But what was it that convinced you, you know what, I need to put this together in a book?
It was a culmination of all the information I was able to gather over the years. And one of the squadron mates in Korea said, you know, you need to write a book. It's not just your uncle's story. It's our story. It's every person, especially the Air Force, who went over there to Korea, fought in Korea, and especially for those who never came home. It's their story as well. You need to share it with everybody.
And I'm sure it was a lot of work.
Oh, it was a lot of work. A lot of research.
Was it worth it?
Oh, yeah. I believe so.
What has made it worth it? Can you give us an example of some feedback you got? I know there's some fantastic quotes on the back jacket of your book from some high-ranking Air Force officers who talk about what they got out of it and what it means to them. But what's been the most meaningful feedback that you've received since writing the book?
I think the way I could help other people, that I was looking for information, I was able to match people that haven't seen each other for 50 years. So that helped me, knowing these pilots who didn't see each other for 50 years could get reunited. They could get their interest back, learn their history. Because some people don't even remember. They didn't even remember. They said, oh, yeah, did that take place? I didn't recall. It must have happened. So, you know, it's a teaching experience, basically. So I was thrilled with that. So mm-hmm. I was able to help others at the same time I was trying to help myself.
And it's amazing when you really seek to help others how much you end up benefiting in the long run, isn't it?
Yes, sure is.
I bet you've learned a lot about the Korean War.
I've learned quite a bit. I didn't even know where Korea was. When I was 8 years old and started, I had never heard of Korea. I was doing a lot of World War II. I was always in the library getting books about World War II. I could go to Iwo Jima, Okinawa, and all those places, like in Europe. I had never heard of Korea. So it was fascinating to learn all this stuff. And I'm still learning, by the way.
Yeah, and you mentioned right off the bat, it's known as the Forgotten War. And you have a reason to make sure it isn't forgotten, and you've preserved your uncle's memory. You've uncovered your uncle's story and preserved it and shared it with so many people through the writing of this book. So for those people who really don't know much about the Korean War, what are the things that you hope, for your uncle's sake and to honor his legacy, that people do understand and remember about that time in our country's history?
Well, one good evidence is just look at South Korea. I mean, they're just a well-built society. And compare that with how North Korea is. People say that, you know, we lost, like a Korean War was the first we lost before even Vietnam. But actually, we didn't lose. We maintained their democratic way of life, basically.
Yeah, so, don't go to South Korea and say you lost, because they'll show you how much they appreciate it.
No, those South Korean, they just love America. They love, and the veteran especially.
I'm sure you've seen it. I think every Korean War vet I've spoken to over the years has pointed out those nighttime photographs from space of the Korean Peninsula.
Yeah.
South Korea is
all lit up.
And North Korea?
Dark.
Yeah, nothing.
Nothing.
But somewhere in that darkness, somewhere in that black section of the map, is probably your uncle.
Somewhere, someplace.
Are you ever going to stop trying to find out where he is and the full story of what happened?
No, we never stop. There's no end. There won't be end to it until his remains are found, brought back. Then I could write another conclusion or another epilogue to the story. One part of writing it is hoping other people will copy what I'm doing. They don't have to write a book, but just to, if you have a relative that's been missing or lost or maybe killed in a war, to get as much information as you can on them. Don't have them as a statistic, as a number, but they have a life. Remember how they lived, not so much how they died, but how they lived and who they were and what they did for this country.
Yes, well said. And when we come back, we're going to hear from a man who might be able to help you find what you're looking for. He's done that for over 1,000 families. But thank you, Jim Escal. What a tremendous tribute to your Uncle Jimmy you've put together in your book, Unforgotten Hero. Go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos and info on the book. You're also going to find a link to the work of World War II researcher Bill Beagle. And we'll meet Bill when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special Memorial Day edition of the program, remembering those who have paid the ultimate price for our freedom.
In World War II, that number was more than 406,000. Maybe you have a connection to one of those represented by a wall of gold stars at the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. But how much do you really know about those young Americans whose lives were cut short? Would you like to know more? Well, time to meet a guy who might be able to help. Bill Beagle, World War II researcher and author, son of a Korean War veteran. His website is ww2research.com. And if you're on Twitter, follow his account. His posts put names and faces on those who have died while serving our country. Bill, thanks for meeting me here in the studios of Hometown Heroes affiliate KNZR in Bakersfield, California.
How did it come about that you started researching for the families of those who died in World War II, the details and the circumstances of their passing?
Well, you know, you just mentioned my dad, and that's a perfect lead-in. My dad was growing up in Detroit, Michigan during the war. He was living with cousins. And they were struggling to find a place to live because of the war. So they moved in with some cousins, and my dad had a cousin that was 7 years older than him named Morris Myers. Morris went into the Air Corps, became a gunner on a B-17, 381st Bomb Group, and all that his family ever heard was that in July of 1943, he was missing in action over Germany. And so my dad grew up always wondering about Morris. It was kind of an older brother to him. So my dad came to me one day in the late 90s and said, "Hey, Bill, I know you're a World War II enthusiast. Can you find something about my cousin?" I said, "Sure." So that was kind of what started it off. And the Morris Myers story is a sad one because he was not missing in action over Germany. In fact, his B-17 disappeared with four other B-17s flying from Newfoundland to Scotland. They went down in a storm over the Atlantic Ocean, and no one ever knew. The family never really knew the story.
How much of it were you able to piece together?
Well, I was able to find a lot because on Morris Myers' crew was a guy whose dad, it was the co-pilot of the crew, his dad was an attorney who had some connections. And in the file, it shows the letters the father of the co-pilot wrote to the Air Force saying, "You know, my son is missing. What can you tell me?" And so he got back the usual non-information letters. But then what the guy did was he wrote a letter to the Newfoundland Province Department of Tourism. And he did it because he wanted to know what the weather would be like. Mm-hmm. Because he started to think maybe weather was an issue. So he got back this big brochure that says, "Usually the weather is good in July, but at the beginning of the month of July, it can still be pretty bad." So from there, this man found an officer that was up at the base up there. And the officer said that we had incredible pressure to get these B-17s over to combat. And so although we had a rule that said if the weather is so bad, you got to keep them on the ground, this one guy that was running the base said, "I don't care what the weather's like, we got to get these guys out of here." So the reason that these four planes went down, I think three of them made it, four didn't, was because of the pressure to get these guys into combat. So here you had 40 guys and four aircraft lost before they even got there.
Tragic.
Yeah.
And there are so many stories like that in World War II. But like your family, most of the families really have very few details. If anything, some don't even know whether the person actually died at that moment or survived for a while. And details are so hard to come by. And I'm sure there are a lot of families listening right now. Maybe it's a son, a daughter, a grandson, a granddaughter who has heard this line, which I'm sure you've probably heard from a lot of the families you work with. "Sorry, all the records burned down in a fire."
Correct. So what happened was in 1973 at the National Personnel Records Center, a fire did occur. It destroyed 80 to 90% of World War II era records for the Army. And one of the things that's not spoken about so much is that Marine and Navy and Coast Guard records were not destroyed. So those records are out there. But if you're looking for Army or Air Force, those records were destroyed. And I used to live in St. Louis, and I know what it's like in the summer there. And I'm sure that fire just went ripping through that place like nobody's business.
But even some of those records that burned in the fire and that people have been told you can't find anything else out, some of those you're able to piece together. There are microfilms that exist on some of them. And then there are other records, if you go to the after-action reports down at the unit level, that you can find. How much of that have you done?
I've done an incredible amount of that. Another thing that I do is that after World War II, most of the states, I think 36 of the 48 states, paid a bonus to World War II vets, and they kept those records. Now, what's good about that is when they made the law for these bonus payments, of course, they said you've got to be able to prove that you were a veteran, or if you were killed, your family has to prove it. So a lot of the state records have a lot of the burned records in them because the people were able to pull those records to say, "Hey, this is proof." So that's one of the ways I do a workaround.
And that's one of the reasons I was excited about having you on this show, because you've done so much of this. And there are so many people who maybe they try a little bit. Maybe they find a government website. They type in a name. Nothing comes back.
Right.
Or they hear it burned down in a fire and they give up. But it's still like it stuck in your father's mind for all that time.
Right.
It still sits with you. You want to know. You want answers. And I'm hoping that by sharing your story and how you've helped others find their family's stories, that some people listening today will take the opportunity, take the initiative to reach out and start that journey of discovering more information, because you never know what it's going to lead.
That's right.
And you've got some pretty good examples of some of the families that you've worked with. And I don't know how you choose if you've worked with, what, over 1,000 families?
Yeah, over 1,000 families.
Holy cow. In how long of a time?
Starting about 1998 or 99.
Just because you wanted to.
Just because I wanted to. Right. And, you know, I'm a professional, so I get compensated some, but it's not, you know, I'm not going to Millionaire Acres on this one. So
how long typically, and I don't want to, you know, scare anyone away or intimidate them. If someone says, okay, this is my dad, my grandpa, we don't know anything. On average, how long would it take you to complete that portfolio and that file of information?
If they are Navy or Marines or Coast Guard, I'll usually give somebody about a 6-month estimate. And that includes writing off the letters and doing all the bureaucratic stuff I have to do. I have other people, if they want to know about their father or someone that was shot down, I've got a huge database of missing aircrew reports. And so often I can say, I can get this to you next week. Now, I do have other ones where when I'm working on those who are in the Army or Air Corps that died in the war, that search can take me 14 months, maybe. 13, 14, 15 months. And there's just no way around it. The Army is difficult to work with.
So it's not that it takes you all those hours to do it. You're constantly, you know, at any given time, you're working on a number of projects.
Right.
But just the time to go back and forth with the government and these documents, that's the hang up.
Right. And then a lot of times they'll come back and say that serial number is wrong, or they won't come back at all. And then I have to follow up and call them and that whole routine.
So you're constantly on your toes, but
all
I know it makes a big difference to the families. One of the things that you've done that I think is really neat, and maybe it's because I'm so involved in college sports and have announced so many college ball games, including quite a few at UCLA, you went through and you discovered every student, faculty member, anyone who had a connection to UCLA during World War II who died during the war. That's a big project.
Yeah.
And what is that number?
They gave me a list of about 125 names, and I found almost double that they didn't have on their list.
Wow.
And yeah, a number of them were athletes, and then a number of them were just regular students. Some of them were frat guys. You know, I found their photos there, and others of them were, you know, guys that were only there for a few months. There was one faculty member who was killed in the Navy, killed in a blimp crash off New Jersey.
Wow.
Yeah.
And I think for those of us who grew up after World War II, I think it's really hard for us to grasp how all-consuming this was. And every college campus around the country changed in an instant. The best athletes are going off to war. Some of the instructors, they're going off to war or doing something else war-related. And that certainly was the case at UCLA. And I know I've talked to some folks before, some of the greatest names in UCLA history. You think of John Wooden, was supposed to be on the USS Franklin, which was kamikaze.
Absolutely.
He could have been killed and never had a coaching career.
Right.
I'm sure you've heard Jackie Robinson's story about
of
a
course.
Fight saving him from combat.
Absolutely true.
So that's just a couple Bruin legends. But here you are finding out the stories of those Bruins whose stories were never told, who might have been names like Wooden and Robinson and never had the chance.
Right. And also interesting because UCLA was a more integrated kind of school than many other schools were. So I've done, I believe there were 6 Japanese Americans from UCLA that died in the war. 1 Chinese American, Francis Wei, who was later a Medal of Honor winner. There were actually 5 women from UCLA. 4 of them were WASP flyers. And then the last was a Navy corpsman or a corps woman who died from dental surgery that went wrong.
Wow. As you're going through each one of those stories, is this just data? Is this just information? Or do you start to almost get a feel for who this person really was and even the personality and the interactions with others?
I dream about these guys sometimes. And they're very, very interesting, very realistic dreams. So they're not just pieces of information to me. They're very, very personal.
And when you think about it, when all this was going on, keeping records was so difficult. That's why the records in war are so hard sometimes to pin down. I mean, if someone dies, the records that he was going to hand in might not ever make it where they're going.
Right.
It's so murky. And We didn't have the computers we have now.
Right.
So it really is, you're almost like an explorer, aren't you? You're like a Columbus in World War II research.
You know, sometimes if I'll get a guy and we'll find that he died in a certain town, and then I'll find the after-action report for his regiment, and it says they were in a hole, they were 20 miles away. So I'm trying to piece together, what was this guy doing, you know, on the other side of the river when his whole unit hadn't crossed yet? You know, all kinds of stuff like that.
Yeah, and there really is no end. And I think
that's
probably one of the things that keeps you going. You never know what incredible nugget you're going to discover next time.
I never do. And what I love is from time to time, I'll get a case where I can't find anything about these guys in advance. Flat out zero. And those are my favorite guys because it's a mystery. You don't know, was he in the Philippines? Was he in Germany? It's very, very satisfying.
And I guess more importantly, the family doesn't know.
No, the family doesn't know. Or I just did a flyer where the family said he was shot down over Australia. And I said, well, not a lot of guys were shot down over Australia, but it could have been a plane crash anyway. Turned out he was shot down over Germany.
Maybe someone was talking about Austria once upon a time and it
could
got
be.
Transposed.
Yeah, could be.
And that's, again, really why I wanted to have you on this show, to give hope to some of those families who do have unanswered
right.
questions, who would love to fill in the blanks. And why don't you give us an example? We talked about UCLA and
sure.
that great project there, and what a treasure for the Bruins. Every school in America should have that.
Couldn't agree more.
The kids on campus today are the same age those guys were, right?
That's right.
You want to talk perspective and putting things in perspective.
Right.
But let's talk a little bit about some of the specifics of some of these families that you've talked to. Tell me about this P-51 pilot, First Lieutenant
sure.
Julio Nuno. Is that
that's, that's right. I was contacted by his daughter in 2012. She never knew him. She had a photograph of him and her mother and her when she was about two, but she didn't remember him. And like so many other cases after the war, her mother remarried, and there just wasn't a lot to be said about her father. Her stepfather, I think, wasn't real interested in maybe a rival, let's say, from the past.
Sure.
So she knew nothing about him. So she went through all the steps. She wrote away for his records. They came back and said, burned in the fire, don't exist, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so I knew that because he was a flyer and because of a few other tricks of the trade, I knew that I would at least be able to find out about his last mission, which I did. He was a P-51 flyer, shot down over Germany, crashed in a meadow across a little stream from a town. And she didn't even know that. She just knew he'd been shot down. Anyway, we were able to find that when he was shot down, he was buried by the local German undertaker in this little town in a grave with five dead German soldiers. And so 3 years after the war, when the Americans went through looking for him, because they had records that said he went down somewhere around here, they found him with these deceased Germans in there. And they were able to exhume him. And then they wrote a letter to the mother, who was in the process of getting remarried at the time. And so there was this big bureaucratic headache over who's going to be in charge of the remains. Is it the widow? Is it the mother? And so all that was lost to my client. And so once I found the records and I sent them to her, she called me up and she was, you know, almost in tears because now her father is becoming this real person. And the records were able to say his physical characteristics. He was 5'8", 150 pounds, brown hair, brown eyes, 8.5 shoe size. And she didn't even know that. She just knew that some of his brothers said that this is what he looked like. But it was very exciting for her. So we've been corresponding for the last couple months just over that.
And I'm sure in that process, you just kind of gave us a nutshell sketch there, but that happened over a long period of time.
It did.
And I'm sure he hit a few dead ends.
I hit three dead ends. Part of the problem was that his name was recorded wrong. His name is Nuno, N like Nancy, but in a few of the Army records, they have him as Muno, M like Mary. So that was just, I was banging my head against the wall on that one because, you know, for obvious reasons. But with some perseverance and some little bit of skill, I was able to finally track him down.
So that's the primary focus of your work is finding things out about people who died in the war.
Right.
Are you ever asked by families, because I run into a lot of folks like this, their father, their uncle, their grandfather fought in the war, came home, never talked about
Didn't want to talk about
for
it.
For decades and decades.
Right.
Died without telling his story, but
right.
they want to piece together the story now.
Right.
You ever work with those folks?
Yeah, I do. I find that, again, records for the Air Corps or what we would call the Air Force today tend to be better. I do a lot of work with people that say, my dad flew 25 missions. We think it was a B-24, but we don't even know. We think maybe he was flying out of Italy or maybe Germany. We don't really know. But there are ways to piece together the complete flying career of a guy. Every mission he flew, what happened to the plane, even some of the training accidents. There were thousands of training accidents, and the records are very good for those. So whenever I do an Air Corps person, first thing I do is I say, let's see if we can find an accident report when they were stateside, and then we go from there.
Well, and I'm sure there's a lot of people that are interested in doing that, and especially on Memorial Day as they reflect on their loved one, that they would love to find out some more information. And that's how I always encourage folks. You never know where that journey is going to take you, but you're going to find something. And before we talk about another individual here, I'm curious, you probably have a lot of stories like this, but can you give us an example of something that you really didn't expect, that maybe you even wonder, how in the world did that happen? Is that serendipity? Is somebody somewhere pulling a string to help me out here? How did I come across this piece of information at this time that opened up a whole new world to me?
That's a great question. I did a guy, one of the first guys I did was a guy named Jack McHenry. He was a private first class in a tank unit in Germany. Survived the war, only to die 3 weeks later. There was nothing on him. The only report I could find was one that said he drowned in a river in what later became East Germany. But that was it. I started to dig into some of the higher level of records. And one of the interesting things I found was a report that said he'd been killed by a member of the German resistance, which was known as the Werewolf movement. And it was funny to read it because it the way that it was written was killed by werewolf, which made it seem like a very strange story.
The military believed in werewolves, huh?
Yeah, you know, that's a little-known fact from the 1940s. So,
were they keeping them in Roswell? Is it part of that file, too?
Perfect. So anyway, it turned out that I met a guy that knew him who lived up in the San Francisco Bay Area, and I was up there on company business for my profession at the time, so I was able to sit down and meet him. And I said, you know, Jack McHenry, what do you think happened? And he said, you know, Bill, Jack McHenry was an operator. And I said, what do you mean by operator? And he said, well, he was a guy, he'd go to the PX and he'd buy everything in there. He'd buy watches, he'd buy overcoats. Then what he would do is he'd go down to the river, and on the other side of the river was the Russian army, because the Russian army had stopped on their westward movement. American army had stopped on their eastman movement on this particular river. And so he would go and sell these Russians. And for various reasons, the Russians were being paid in American money, which is a whole nother strange story. But anyway, so he'd get this $2 wristwatch and sell it to some guy for $100 because these Russians didn't know the value of the money. So my friend up in the Bay Area believed that the Russians got wise to him, because what happened to McHenry was he was on guard duty from midnight to 1 a.m. on Memorial Day weekend, curiously enough. And when his relief went back to the barracks to get the two replacements, they got back to the bridge and McHenry was gone. No sign of a struggle. His rifle was there on the ground. A complete mystery. Anyway, with some luck and some research, I was able to find the autopsy that the Army did, because 4 days after he disappeared, they found him floating upriver. A guy was out fishing and saw this big green thing coming down the river, and that was McHenry in his green fatigues. And the report was very ambiguous, but it said that he had a knot on his head the size of a goose egg, and they hadn't determined, did he get it falling off the bridge? Did somebody hit him? But anyway, I was able to find all sorts of stuff about this guy, and it was very, very gratifying.
I imagine, and so the big break for you, so to speak, was connecting with someone who actually knew him.
It was. And the way that that story ends is we talked for a couple hours. He was one of these guys that he told me, you know, Bill, my own sons don't care about this stuff, so I want to show you something. He went out of the room, came back in with this old shoebox, and it turned out that the shoebox had all his souvenirs from the war, all sorts of things, German medals, really interesting stuff. And he said, Bill, I want you to have it. And I said, I can't take this. You got to give it to one of your two boys. And he said, Bill, they were never interested in that. And so I really want you to have it. I really enjoy talking. And I said, well, of course I'll take it then. So I did. And when my kids were middle school students, their middle school did a career day every year. And so I would go and talk about what I do at the career day. And what was very interesting is that the kids 1 year had just read The Diary of Anne Frank. So they knew about concentration camps. And so I took out some of the medals. And some of them showed that they had been made in a concentration camp.
Wow.
And so, you know, middle school kids can get kind of wild. But as soon as I said that and showed some of them where this had been made, the class just was dead silent. And it was really a neat experience.
I imagine so. And just hearing you tell that story and realizing that the reason all this unfolded was you're able to connect with someone who actually knew that individual.
Right.
And I've had some similar experiences at times. And when you realize that, it's a great adrenaline rush. It's
absolutely.
Like, holy moly.
Absolutely.
But it also hits me that in a few years, with the World War II generation,
right.
that's no longer going to be possible.
That's right. They'll all be gone. Yeah.
Is that going to change the work that you do?
Well, it won't change it too much because most of the time I do work with records. And, boy, I have a database that's just giant now that's maybe somebody else somewhere is doing this sort of thing. But I've got stuff where I can really make some quick finds because it's my records only. No one else has got them.
Again, Bill's website is ww2research.com. I want to ask you about another gentleman that I read about on your website, but also, and this show focuses primarily on our World War II veterans, but we're also aware that so many were lost in the other battles. And every time we have one of these honor flights to Washington, D.C., you see what it means to veterans of all generations to visit the World War II Memorial, the Korean Memorial, and maybe the most emotional is the Vietnam Memorial with all 58,000-plus names on there. I know you do work with those generations
sure
of
do.
Veterans as well.
Yep.
And with Korea and Vietnam, there sure are a lot of bodies that have never been recovered. Have you had any success in tracking down information about those who no one's ever been able to locate their remains?
I have been able to come very close to where these guys should be or were after their deaths, really kind of pinpointing them. I did some work for a couple of Tuskegee flyers that were shot down New Year's Eve 1944 over Germany. Very interesting story because they went down over land. Neither of these guys were ever found. And my initial belief, which I still hold to, is that if they survived their crashes, they might have been killed on the ground by Germans, who would have been very quick to kill African-American soldiers. But anyway, that's one of my ongoing projects. I've got one of the sites narrowed down very closely. The other one's getting there. So I'm hoping that with a little more work, at least we can confirm the crash sites and then go from there.
Do you have, this is probably an overused analogy, but is there a holy grail out there for you? Is there one piece of information or one quest that is still unsatisfied for you that keeps you doggedly pursuing this?
I've got one guy I'm working on that I've been working on for 7 years. I refunded my client's money 5 years ago, and I said, I'm going to keep looking for this guy. So that guy is my holy grail. He was a flyer, 8th Air Force, and the records, we found his crash report, so we got that far. But I don't know if his file is sitting in a Department of Agriculture, you know, room somewhere or what the story is, but that guy is my holy grail.
Well, if you ever find him, I hope you'll get in touch.
I will.
We'll put you back on the show and hear how the incredible twists and turns of
Absolutely.
Making that happen. With regard to the UCLA project that you did, and that's a huge project.
It sure was. Took me 5 years.
Wow. And you said 261?
I think 261 was the number then. I'm up to almost 270 now because what I did was, it was so interesting to me that even after it was complete, I said, I'm going to keep looking. And so I just got the file for a guy last week, Navy flyer. He was a physics major at UCLA. It's great to read his file because all these different groups in the Navy wanted him to come work for him because he was one of these, he was a genius. And finally, he was went in and became a flyer, and he was being transferred from one base to another in the Pacific, and the plane went down over the ocean, and I think 18 guys all were killed, all non-recoverable. So that was just a UCLA guy I found just in the last couple of weeks.
Well, and I know I'm bouncing around here, but just listening to that description, one of the things I talk about with all the veterans who come on this show, and it has personal relevance. When I interviewed my grandfather years ago, and he told me the story of how he earned a Silver Star pulling 26 guys out of burning tanks.
My goodness.
I said, when everyone else was getting out of there and you kept going back in, what were you thinking? And he said, well, I thought I was going to get killed. And I said, I'm glad you didn't. And he said, yeah, you wouldn't be around.
Right.
And so often I talk to these veterans about who wouldn't be here, the children, right. grandchildren, great-grandchildren who wouldn't have been born, the impact that these people have had on our communities all over this country. So when you take that UCLA project, for example, you look at these 270 names, you read about the talents, the experiences,
right.
the adventures. Do you ever find yourself projecting and saying, man, this person would have done this and this and this and this?
Oh, I think about that all the time. And I even think about them in a more easygoing way, I guess. I was out in Westwood, out at UCLA, maybe a year ago, and I was in a part of the area where they've got the cement on the sidewalk was put down in the 1930s. You can see a little stamp that says that. And so I thought, I wonder how many of my guys walked across this same piece of pavement 70, 75 years ago. And I really think about those guys that way.
I would imagine so. And I'm sure in doing all this research, some people might, you know, maybe someone's listening in Albuquerque today or Salem, Oregon, and they're saying, UCLA, what do I care about UCLA? But I'm sure in that sample of all those people, you found people from a whole bunch of hometowns all
Absolutely.
Over California and the country.
Absolutely. Probably 80% of them are from California, but another 20% some New Yorkers. In fact, I just did a story on my website about one of the guys that was from New York. He was a P-38 pilot that went missing over one of the Aleutian Islands. And they found him a few years later, but he was a New Yorker. And then a number of guys from North Carolina, South Carolina. And in fact, two of the UCLA guys had ships named after them in the U.S. Navy, which was a neat find.
Yeah, that's really neat.
Yeah.
Tell me about Max Poster.
Yeah, Max Poster is an interesting story. I worked for his niece, who happens to be a friend of my wife. And part of this, the struggle we had with Max Poster is that the Army had him listed as Max Poster, and they had him as Max Posternak. They had him both ways, and you can read some reports. They got him both ways in the same report. So very, very confusing to find out about him. But he was a guy that was serving in Italy right at the very end of the war, came from a big family, I think six kids. Actually, he was born in Canada. His family immigrated to Montreal, born there. Then he came to the United States, got a citizenship. And that was part of the problem, too, because the Army was going back and forth. Is this guy a citizen? Is he not? And I think part of the other struggle was that his death was so near the end of the war that the Army called it the casualty surge. And the last 6 months of World War II, you saw a giant spike in casualties. You saw these guys getting killed in Germany as well as Iwo Jima and Okinawa and the Philippines. And so they were almost overwhelmed. So we had the struggle with his last name being uncertain, his citizenship being uncertain, and the time he was killed being this time of the casualty surge. So it was a very challenging project.
How did you break through all of that?
Well, the way that I broke through it was first I went after his records asking for them with both his names, and then I was able to get his regimental after-action report for the day he was killed. And it was a very good one because he was in what was called the 10th Mountain Division, which was somewhat of an elite unit. So they kept better records than some of the other infantry regiments. And for the day he was killed, there were two pages. And so I said, boy, I have hit gold here. So I was able to track down where the regiment was. I think it was a little town called Seriglio, something like that in Italy. And so that's what sort of broke it open for me. And then at the end of the report, they listed the guys from the regiment that died that day. And son of a gun, there was Max. And so I said, okay, I've got the right guy. They listed him as Poster, not Posternak. So I went back again looking for Poster, and this time I found the file. And it was a great, great piece of history.
What would you say is the single most amazing turn of events, break in a case, development that you've encountered over the years that you're just stunned and said, how in the world did that happen?
Well, I did one for, I was just looking at the file the other day, doing this work for a client. This was a PFC in the Army stationed in Alaska, and the family knew almost nothing about him. And all they had was an old newspaper clipping that said he died at Fort Richardson, Alaska. Anyway, in the course of some other work, I was able to find a report, and the report was, it listed all the guys at the unit that had died in the past month. And the reason they were doing it was they wanted to advertise to all the local creditors to say, look, if this guy owes you money for this watch that he bought on credit, sorry, but it ain't going to happen because this is what happened. And so I said, son of a gun, that's one of my guys. So that was a huge break. And it turned out he was on a ship and they were loading some very non-military stuff. They were loading mattresses, I think, onto the ship. one of the cranes broke, and all these mattresses, including the metal container that they were in, fell on the guy and killed him. Because it was such a kind of an oddball sort of event, the Army did an investigation. So I found the report, and I think there were 20 witnesses that gave their story on this. A couple other guys were hurt, but this poor guy was crushed. And so that was one of the ones where I just said, who would have ever guessed going in that this is what the story is for this guy?
Do you ever get to the point where you bring these details and all this information back to the family and they're disappointed by what you found?
They're never disappointed. Sometimes they want it to be specific. And so I have to say that, well, you know, the regiment lost 30 guys this day. So they couldn't pinpoint maybe the house the guy died in. Now, I did do a guy that they did find the house he died in. A tank drove through. He was a radio man in the Battle of the Bulge, and a tank drove right through the command post, a German tank. And so we were able to actually find the exact location. They're not disappointed. Now, what I do is that some of the reports are very graphic, and they'll say, we're sending home this guy's personal possessions, but we want you to know that some of them are bloodstained. Do you still want us to send them in? And most of the time, they said yes. A few times, they said no, destroy them. So there's that, too.
What keeps you going at this? What's the satisfaction or fulfillment that you get out of this work?
Well, every case is something different. Even if I've done cases where I've researched all 10 guys on a plane, and you might think that they're going to come out and be fairly similar, but they never are. You've got maybe a couple of the officers are college guys, a couple of the gunners were 8th grade graduates, but you never know any of that going in. And it's just great to see where all these guys came from. You know, the pilot is a UCLA grad, so he's from Los Angeles, and the co-pilot's from Colorado, and you know, it's just that great piece of America that's so interesting and so satisfying to work on. So I never get tired of this stuff.
And we've heard those stories from a lot of vets on this program telling about their crews and how they came from such diverse backgrounds, but all drew together behind the common cause of America and the Allied victory in World War II. What have you learned? As you said, before you ever started this journey, you were into World War II.
Yeah, I was. My dad was a history teacher. He taught high school and community college, so I was always interested, kind of in the back of my mind. But when my dad asked me about this one guy, his cousin Morris Myers, it was like all the light switches went on. I said, this is work I want to do.
So through all that work, and I know you've worked with veterans who died in other wars
yeah.
as well, but what have you learned that maybe you didn't understand
sure.
before about the men and women who served in our armed forces in World War II?
Sure. Well, of course, very young. I think the average age of death was 26 for a serviceman in World War II. But I've done a lot of guys that were just out of high school. They graduated in June of 1944, and there was this poor guy in Belgium in the Battle of the Bulge and dying in December of 1944. So I learned a lot about how young these guys were. I learned about, especially working with the infantrymen, how many of them died in artillery attacks. The vast majority, 80% of them, artillery or mortar fire. And so that's always sort of stayed with me because I just feel for these guys. You know, they're stuck in a ditch somewhere and the shelling's coming in and everybody's trying to get out of there. And, that was another thing I learned.
Has it given you a different perspective on your own existence?
Well, I have certainly thought, would I really want to be there? Would I like to be on a B-24? And a few times I thought, yeah, boy, that'd be interesting. But then I look at what these guys went through, and not just the poor guys that lost their lives, but the guys that were POWs for 2, 3, even 4 years on occasion. And so, it's given me a great sense of gratitude. And the other thing I'll say about that is that the way that the U.S. military took care of these guys was far superior to what any other nation did in the war. They very carefully cataloged all their personal effects and mailed them home. They were extremely careful with identifying the remains, and then America was the only nation that brought home its dead after the war. And so I've got a book that I'm just about done with now on that topic. And that in itself, the commitment of the United States to their veterans was just simply incredible, to the veterans and their next of kin.
Well, and that probably has something to do with the fact that America was so united at the time, and the folks back home were working very hard to make
Absolutely.
Sure the victory would come about. If there's someone out there who's listening, and they don't know what happened to their loved one who died in World War II or any other conflict that
yeah.
America's been in, What's the best piece of advice you can give them?
Well, if you're looking for somebody that died in World War II, the first thing that I would do, and it's surprising how often this works, I would just go in and Google their name. Doesn't always give you something, but it's often a good starting point, because you might see that you'll come to a website for everybody that's buried in the Bakersfield Cemetery. And son of a gun, there's Dad. So that's a starting place. I'd say just Google their name. Another thing I would look at is the website for the World War II Memorial, because they've got a registry there that is supposed to list every guy that died in World War II. It doesn't, but it's a good start.
Because it's voluntary to submit a name.
Right.
And that, you know, you bring that up, and now you got me started.
Okay.
A lot of the veterans, when we... Honor flights have been going on from all over the country to the World War II Memorial, because veterans want to see this memorial to those they knew. So many World War II veterans get to that memorial.
Yeah.
And while they're moved by its grandeur and the wall of gold stars that represents 400,000 Americans means something to them, a lot of them are disappointed that there is not a wall with all the names.
I couldn't agree more. I think one of the worst mistakes they made was not doing that. And I often thought maybe they could even do something where they have an LED display, and each day they pick a different guy randomly and say, Morris Myers is this guy, or Max Posternak is this guy. But I agree. I like the memorial, but it is absolutely impersonal.
And it's a beautiful memorial, and I don't mean to knock it at all, but my question is, and we've actually talked about this where I live in the Central Valley of California, should there be somewhere in this country a physical monument with every single one of those more than 400,000 names, and is that doable?
Well, I'll tell you, I did a project for Brownsville, Texas. The Rotary Club found an old memorial they had from after the war with about 100 names on it, and a lot of the names were misspelled. A lot of these guys were Hispanic guys from the farms, and when their parents requested that they get on this wall, they maybe didn't spell the name right. But what they asked me to do is they said, we want to know the last day that this guy served the United States. So typically the day he was killed. And so they had me research all 110 guys to get the day that they died. And so their new memorial, which opened up in 2009, I think, has got that. So is it doable? Absolutely. Should it be done? Absolutely.
I guess the thing I wondered, and I think it has to be done, and it has to be done before it's too late.
Right.
Because there are... you know, more than 400,000 Americans, that's a whole lot of families who would like to have somewhere to go to see that name actually etched somewhere. From a logistical standpoint, is there a risk that whatever list ended up in stone or bronze or whatever it would be incomplete?
Well, it would. And one of the problems is the way that casualties were recorded in World War II. The Navy and the Marines recorded them differently than the Army did. And the particular problem is that the Navy and the Marines recorded non-battle deaths a very different way than battle deaths. So, for example, on the registry for the World War II Memorial, they don't have any non-combat deaths for Navy and Marines. So very few people that I've ever talked to know that. I've talked to people at the National Archives that didn't know that there was that mistake, and that there are lists of the non-combat dead, but they're very difficult to find. I've only located them in the Los Angeles Public Library and a library in Baltimore. It's the only two spots I've ever located them.
Well, maybe we can work on this. Maybe we can make it happen. It might take someone of your skills to bring together that complete list, and as long as we leave a little space to add a few names on the back end, maybe we could pull it off. It would certainly be worthwhile. You know, I stumbled onto your work because one of the veterans on this show told this story of a young man he served with who he tended to as a combat medic who died in the war, and this gentleman, by a chance occurrence, encountered his mother, the dead soldier's mother. He was one of those UCLA students that you did all the research on. And since then, I've followed you on Twitter. Not a big Twitter guy, but I've noticed that on Twitter, quite often, you're posting on a specific date information about an American soldier who died on that date in history.
Right.
How do you do that? Do you just have a database that reminds you what date it is, or are you just going off memory?
I've got my own personal database. So for every day in World War II, from December 7th, 41, till whatever date in 1945, I have at least one guy that I've researched. So what I do is every morning, in fact, I even did one this morning before I came up here, I take a look and I say, okay, I have four guys that died on May 6th. And sometimes it's just kind of a feeling like, okay, I'm going to pick this guy today. And when I do it next year, I'll pick another guy that died that day. But my records are very extensive, so I can almost always pull out a page. I've got photos of a fair amount of these guys, and I can put that out there too.
What's the most satisfying comment or feedback you've ever received from one of these families who hired you to research their loved one?
You know, the one that I liked was I did a guy that was a B-17 gunner. He was flying in North Africa. Plane took off. The plane flipped over in a sandstorm, and all the guys on the plane were killed. This guy was from El Paso, Texas, and by the luck of the draw, in the file were the names of all nine of his brothers and sisters. A huge family. And so my client actually did a family reunion based on my research because he was able to find all the long-lost cousins and nephews. And that was a great experience. He was so excited and so happy to do it. And, you know, that'll always stay with me.
You never know what you're going to find.
Right.
Said it once, say it again. Is there anything that we haven't discussed, Bill, that you think people should be aware of or something that maybe should add a little hope for those who think, you know, there's no way I'm ever going to learn anything about my dad or grandpa?
Sure. One thing I'll say is if they died in the war, the records are there somewhere. So that you can find them if you know what you're doing and you're willing to be patient. That's one thing I would say. I think the other thing I would say is find out what you can about them before you start the search. Sometimes it's better to do the background work up front. That'd be another piece of advice, I think.
I'm sure that when you do this, as long as you've done it, and for as many different clients as you've done this research for, sometimes it jumbles together, or maybe you can lose your sensitivity to the emotion of it all. So when Memorial Day rolls around for you, what are the emotions that you experience? And in your mind, having dealt with so much of the nuts and bolts of people who have died while serving our country, that paid the ultimate price for our freedom, what does Memorial Day mean to you?
You know, it means a lot to me. There is a little memorial near where I live in Palos Verdes, and they have listed four guys from that area that died in World War II. So what I did last year on Memorial Day was I went there, I took a photo of the monument, and then said, for my own interest, I'm going to research these four guys to kind of honor their memory. And so I've completed that now. And I think about these guys all the time. A lot of them are almost real to me for certain cases. So, boy, I think about their sacrifice and how young they were and how terrifying their last moments most likely were. And it's a great feeling just to know that in some small way I'm honoring them.
Well, and when you think about it, a lot of the memorials that were built right after World War II in communities like that, they were built to people who were fresh in people's memories.
Right. And now they're just names.
Right. And at the time, maybe you didn't need all that information
right.
because you knew that's Johnny from down the street.
Exactly.
But now none of us knows.
That's right.
So what's the point? Why is it important for us to know?
Well, I think that, you know, if you're an American and whatever your political point of view is, we live in a place where we have freedom. I mean, we really do. We can vote for whoever we want to, and we can move and change our jobs. And, you know, a lot of the world's not that way. And if these guys had not done what they did, who knows what our lives would be like now. So I've often thought, boy, I hope that someday, some way I'll be able to, you know, look them in the eye in some, you know, spiritual sense and just say, hey, thank you.
That's what it's all about. Well, thank you for what you're doing, and I hope a lot of people will check out your website, www2research.com. Follow
yep.
Bill on Twitter if you want those daily updates that
yep.
remind you the price that's been paid for our freedom. Anything else you think we need to know?
You know, I just hope that if anybody's interested in doing this kind of work, that they don't give up on it, and I'd sure like to help them out if the situation's right.
You never know what you're going to find until you take that first step in the journey of discovery. And we've heard some pretty compelling examples of that today. And we've been reminded that one way to honor those who died while serving our country is to learn more about who they were. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping this Memorial Day and every day we'll all remember that our freedom is not free.